Reporting live tonight from Nova Scotia, Claire and Emily will detail new reports on conservation, wildlife, ecology, and the environment in today's Biosphere Bulletin broadcast. Thank you for that intro, newscaster, and welcome to Write Up Your Algae. My name is Clara.
And I'm Emily.
And we are excited to bring you another Biosphere Bulletin today. So let's talk cats.
The musical?
Yeah. The big hit on Broadway. No. So in my first story, which is from NBC News, I wanted to look at a successful conservation story regarding the Iberian lynx. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Iberian lynx, as was I before I looked into this story, they're considered to be the rarest lynx species and were considered one of the rarest cat species. They live mainly in the Mediterranean woodland forests of Spain. Despite their rarity, the Iberian lynx has shown remarkable resilience. Organizations such as the World Wildlife Fund have been focused on bringing this population back so they do not become extinct. One of the most important factors for conservation in this case is tracking these lynx. According to the World Wildlife Fund, the population of these lynx was less than 100 individuals in 2002. The Iberian lynx has a specialist diet for rabbits, and it's about, I saw some sources saying 80% towards 90% rabbit. The rabbit is a huge staple for the lynx, but there's also around 30 other predators in the Mediterranean forest who feed on rabbit. On average, an Iberian lynx needs to consume one rabbit daily, and this increases when they have young to about 2 to 3. Other organisms in their diet include birds, rodents, and young deer, and I saw some other like young mammals, whatever they can find. But it makes up such a small percentage of their actual overall diet. They have on average 3 young, however, it's rare that more than 2 survive. As well, these Iberian lynx are solitary animals, meaning that they do not have groups in which they operate, and they tend to live or hunt alone, unless, of course, they have their young. They average in weight from about 10 to 13 kilograms and can get up to heights of about 88 to 100 centimeters. So a fairly small animal. Their threats include habitat fragmentation and destruction, forest conversion to agricultural lands and industry, roadkill, poaching, being killed in traps or killed on purpose. This poses a significant challenge to their survival, underscoring the urgency of our conservation efforts.
What's habitat fragmentation?
So it basically means when a habitat is broken up into such small parts, either through, for example, roads is a big way of habitat fragmentation. And sometimes this fragmentation can be so bad because animals can only live in a certain environment. And for them to be able to get there, they have increased mortalities, right? So if you think of big urban centers blocking off animals from there, habitat, like say it's a woodland or something like that, and there's a huge urban area in between point A and point B for them, there's a huge risk for them to go across. So they're fragmented in such a small population. So now that we have a bit of a clearer image of the Iberian lynx, let's dive into the news story. According to this article, in 2001, only 61 mature Iberian lynx were in the wild in the Iberian Peninsula. Thus, the species was considered endangered. However, on Thursday, June 10th, 2024, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, also known as the IUCN, an internationally recognized group that has authority on the status of wildlife, declared that the Iberian lynx was no longer endangered, and in fact, it received the status of vulnerable. And just to give you guys a little bit of understanding what the IUCN is, it's consisted of scientists and non-governmental organizations, governments, businesses, communities, indigenous organizations, and more from over 160 countries. So this change in status is not just a success for the Iberian lynx, but a testament to the collaborative efforts of various stakeholders. This increase in population size is due to extensive efforts by different groups to restore these populations, including monitoring and protecting the wild rabbit populations, education and awareness in communities surrounding the importance of this species, and compensation for farmers who lose livestock if the cats kill any of their livestock. So that's a really good initiative because one of the issues concerning this population of Iberian lynx was there was a lot of farmers who would kill them because they were viewed as, like, a pest or an annoyance.
Mm-hmm.
Reintroduction was another method used to help and protect this species. Over 400 Iberian lynx were captively bred and released into the environment in areas of Portugal and Spain. And before they did these reintroductions, the Iberian lynx had been extirpated from Portugal, so they were no longer present there. And I know this is supposed to be a biosphere bulletin, but I just wanted to explain what reintroduction is and kind of how it worked for the Iberian lynx. And this news story was based off a study that was done. That study was detailed an exploratory and territorial behavior study in a reintroduction or in a reintroduced population of Iberian lynx. So one of the issues that they stated was that with reintroduction, which is introducing a species into an area that had previously been there but is now at lower populations or not at all, these populations are not well managed after a certain point, and this may lead to increased inbreeding and a reduction in genetic diversity. And this could basically facilitate the extinction of that species, especially with reintroduction, which usually happens when there's small populations who do not move very far. The study specifically looked at the behaviors and spatial dispersal of the lynx just after they were introduced, and they found that the reintroduction of the Iberian lynx in Spain was successful with proper management. And as they stated, that it could take over 5 years for the population to establish themselves successfully in that territory. So that's positive for these lynx populations, and hopefully we see the numbers continuing to go up.
Moving on to one of my stories, I just wanted to give a brief little disclaimer, I suppose. So I have three stories for you today, two of which actually occurred a couple of years ago, but the information was only published and made public in the last month. So you might get some, if you maybe decide to look into some of these cool stories further, you might see some different dates. But most of this has been just recent public information, and I just want it to flex right quick. My second story, the Wikipedia page for the species that I'm talking about, was only made 2 hours before I was finding information. So I was right on it, guys, I swear. I'm not laughing just because I'm going to talk about a story that was actually from 2019. It's only been published recently. So for our first story, we're going to Australia. Sharp researchers from James Cook University in North Queensland were tagging marine megafauna off the coast of Orpheus Island in Australia as a part of a 3-year program when they came across a strange observation. The crew, including marine biologist Nicholas Lubitz, were in the process of tagging a tiger shark when the elasmobranch regurgitated a 50-centimeter whole intact echidna. Do you know what an echidna is, Claire?
That's the group with the starfish, right?
No, it's not. Let's get into what an echidna is. Echidnas make up 3 out of 4 members of the order Monotremata, thought to be a stepping stone in the evolutionary pathway from birds and reptiles towards mammals like humans, dogs, mice, etc. Monoterms are endothermic, meaning they are warm-blooded and they can maintain body heat to a certain extent. They have hair and produce milk through mammary glands. As well, they have a single lower jawbone and 3 middle ear bones. But these are all characteristics of mammals. What makes them different is that they still lay eggs, which is a residual trait kept on from birds and reptiles.
So like a platypus.
Yeah, platypus is the one other monoterm. There's like 3 echidnas, there's like long-beaked echidna, and there's like, you know, there's a couple different subspecies. But yeah, they make 3 out of 4, and the 4th one is a platypus. These eggs are a little bit different, though. I think they aren't incubated quite as long as like is typical for like birds and reptiles. So they're a little bit different, as it's like, I guess you can see in evolution as they've moved away from the need for eggs. But monoterm actually comes from the Greek word for single opening, of which they're named, which just refers to the fact that they've carry on the trait of a cloaca. A cloaca is a single reproductive organ, which is responsible for all reproduction and waste removal. So it's just a single opening that kind of does all the jobs that need to be done down there. So it's sort of a less derived version of mammalian reproductive systems, which is a bit more complex. You know, there's a couple different organs that do a bunch of different things. Echidnas resemble porcupines with spikes covering their backs and an elongated snout. And they are terrestrial, which makes it extra strange that a tiger shark would want to munch on one. But some of the researchers, such as Dr. Lubitz, sort of assumed that maybe this echidna was traveling from one island to another, maybe it was feeding, but somehow it managed to get eaten whole by a tiger shark. Tiger sharks are some of the biggest sharks in our oceans, well known for their dynamic diet. They have been seen consuming large garbage, birds, and other sharks. Dr. Lubitz remarked that he's observed tiger sharks eating a rock, and I just thought his quote was really funny, for no reason.
Well,
not a very scientific remark. When recalling the moment, he also, and I quote, said, "When it spatted out, I looked at it and remarked, 'What the hell is that?' And I think the echidna must have felt a bit funny in its throat." To end the story with some good news, the shark was tagged successfully and released unharmed.
Good stuff. Man, tiger sharks are so funny. Okay, so for the next story, I didn't have a cool title, but we're going to be staying in Australia. So I came across this article in Popular Science, which was titled, "Giant Lizards Could Keep Flesh-Eating Maggots Off Australian Sheep." So let's break this title down, because to me it seemed a little bit clickbaity. And I'll also be using information from the peer-reviewed article that it was linked to. So in Australia, they've been having a lot of issues with blowflies laying eggs in sheep, and this costs sheep farmers and sheep farms about $280 million in losses for the industry per year. So that's fairly significant. This disease is caused by the blowflies burrowing eggs in the sheep's skin, and when they hatch, the maggots begin to eat the sheep's flesh and end up, basically, they're eating the animal alive. But, okay, so they titled this disease the fly strike, and I wouldn't say that the maggots are a direct cause of the sheep's death, but they lead to other infections and parasites, and they've also been known to reduce the breeding success of the sheep, and of course, eventually lead to sheep death. The main source of this disease is through carcasses that are not scavenged. And there have been many introductions of species of mammals, such as the red fox, that are thought to somewhat control the carcasses, but there hasn't been a lot of research on what can control the carcasses the best. And of course, there was no studies on what we're going to be talking about, which is native reptile species. In this study titled "Squamate Scavenging Services, Heath Gonens," which is like the scientific name is Varinius Rosenberry, something like that. I'm not very good with Latin. "Support carcasses removal and may support agriculturally damaging blowflies" by Jameson et al. In 2024. And this was published like yesterday. So that was kind of fun to find that article. These Heath Gonens are a lizard reaching up to 5 feet that is endangered in Australia. They do not eat live animals, for the most part. One of their main food sources is carcasses, and they do this through scavenging. They are found in the heathlands of southern Australia. And heathlands are a open stretch of terrain that are mainly found in upland areas with low soil fertility and very few species of shrubs and trees that do not grow very tall. These areas are important habitat to species like birds and reptiles. However, their environment is constantly under threat of urban development. This study was performed in an agricultural land, and they had 4 treatments. And I'll post a cartoon of this on our Instagram because they did a really good job illustrating what the experiment looked like. They used rat carcasses in this experiment. So their first treatment was to leave their carcass accessible to all predators, so just kind of open on the grass. In the second treatment, they used wire mesh tunnel that would only be accessible to the Heath Gonen. The third design was a tall structure, so the carcass could only be accessible to birds. And in the fourth, they used a wire mesh cube that could only be accessed by invertebrates. They found in this study, while although the birds were able to find the carcasses faster and more frequently, the heathgonans were the second most important scavengers, placing them higher than the invasive red fox and feral cats. And they thought that the reason the birds were able to find them a lot easier too was because they were up on this platform. And I'm wondering how you could do a design for birds that wouldn't be so obvious, because it seemed like, you know, if the carcass is raised, it's a lot more obvious and mm-hmm. easier for them to get the bird. So it would be interesting to see how you could do that without having that height difference. These red foxes and feral cats can also lead to a decrease of native scavenging populations in Australia and do not provide the same ecological services. They also mentioned that since the removal of these carcasses by heathgonans were a bit higher than the introduced species, this led to a significant decrease in the maggot populations that were present. They advocated for the removal of the red fox and the feral cat to provide a chance for native populations to take care of some of the blow fly issues that are present in sheep farms. The reason they also address the non-native species is because they're responsible for a lot of native species extinction, and especially where this lizard is endangered, protecting it and giving it a chance to feed and scavenge might help their populations recover a bit. This study lasted for 5 days, and in the news article by Popular Science, it was stated, "It was disgusting. We were counting maggots. After 5 days, we'd find over 1,000 maggots in one rat if a scavenger hadn't found it. These maggots produce blowflies that can spread up to 20 kilometers or 12 miles in a week, putting sheep flocks at a higher risk of fly strike," said Jameson. So that's a pretty significant amount of maggots in just one rat in 5 days, and you can see how this could become a huge problem. So I just had some final thoughts on this story, and I think that it made a lot of interesting points. Sometimes as humans, we introduce other species to an area that can also cause a decline of native populations. Instead, it's important to ensure the health of the native populations, as they oftentimes can provide better and more effective ecological services.
Now we're moving on from Australia. Colorado State University members Joseph Sertic and University of Utah professor Mark Lowen have identified a new plant-eating dinosaur. The specimen was discovered in 2019 in Montana, just 2 miles from the Canadian border. It was in fragments, but the skull was able to be reformed, where they discovered that they had a new and unique species. Estimated to be 22 feet long and perhaps around 11,000 pounds, the dinosaur is a part of the Ceratopsian group, which is known for its frill horns. So did you ever watch The Land Before Time when you were a kid? Sarah, she was a Triceratops. Yeah. I guess that's the one that, the Ceratops that most people would know of, the layman's dinosaur. This specimen had the largest horns of all the other Ceratopsian specimens ever discovered. Furthermore, the specimen was found in a rock layer alongside four other species, showing five different species which lived alongside each other 78 million years ago. Now, during this time period and in this location, this was in swamps and coastal landmass of North America when a seaway was actually dividing the continent. These species were likely geographically limited to a very small area, and they think that they evolved very rapidly in like an isolated environment, which is a process that is sometimes seen in birds. They remarked this, but I feel like, and I might not be relating it correctly, it almost feels like an island effect thing. Like the obvious example that I think of is like Darwin's finches. Like, finches were blown to a new island where they rapidly evolved for different, different prey. Mm-hmm. So they think that this was the kind of case, that these were really unique species. This creature was moved to Norway, and in honor of Norway, as well as for its three horns, the specimen was named Loki Ceratops rangiformis after the Norse god Loki and the antlers of a caribou, which is scientifically known as Rangifer tyrannus. So that's how you get Lokisaurus rangiformis. I just think of Tom Hiddleston.
Alright, so now we're moving on to my next story, and I just wanted to start with a broad question to ask Emily. Emily, can you tell me what eDNA is?
Environmental DNA?
Yes. So, environmental DNA, and just for all of you guys who don't know, DNA stands for deoxyribose nucleic acid. So, in this story, I want to talk about a new study that was published in May. I'll be using information from the study as well as the article from Conservation. The article that I read described how there has been a significant drop in the global vertebrate population in fresh waters since 1970. And the World Wildlife Fund estimates that the total decline reaches about 83% from present day to, actually, I think it was from 2022 to 1970. There's been an 83% decline. So this study aimed to use eDNA, which can be left behind from an organism, whether they're dead or alive. And I kind of think about it as like us leaving dead skin cells everywhere and like hair and everything like that. It's just left behind by the organism, kind of shed off. Something interesting that I had learned in my ecology class, which came up while reading this article, was the use of microinvertebrates to determine the response of an environment to human pressures. So here I will introduce the term biological indicators, which means that they react to changes in the environment and can give us information on what conditions the environment is in based off of the diversity or species and the sensitivity of that species in the fresh water. And that's specifically for this case, so determining how well an ecosystem is doing based off the species that live there. There have been efforts across European countries to improve the quality and health of freshwater bodies. This has helped macroinvertebrate diversity. However, within the last 14 years, efforts have not increased, and in fact, they're at a standstill. New ways of protecting freshwater sources is incredibly important. There are currently two ways that we use for bioindicators in freshwater, and one is called electrofishing. And this is a method where they apply electric current to the water, stunning the fish momentarily, and then someone records and counts all the fish that are in that area. And the other is for microinvertebrates, which is kick net. And I've done this before and it was really cool, except we caught a leech and then I was like, I'm out of here, no thanks.
Well, I'm actually going electrofishing later this summer.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, well, have to chat about it.
Yeah. There are a lot of biases with these methods. Obviously, nothing is perfect in science, but it might prevent a total understanding of the overall quality of the water and then what we can do to improve the water quality. As well, it's hard to standardize these tests for any type of waterway because each waterway is different, especially with like velocity and where a fish can go, maybe they can get out of the electric current, then you're not really having an understanding. And I saw that sometimes small fish can evade the electric currents compared to the big fish. So therefore, this study tried to use eDNA and metabarcoding to determine the taxonomic groups in the water. But this method can't really determine the life stage of the organism. So again, whether they're dead or alive, immature or mature. As well, people have historically claimed that eDNA has no way of showing where the location of the organism is, or even if they're in that waterway. So for example, if you have like a bird or something that's flying over and drops their DNA into that waterway, then you can't say that bird is in that population. People think that it can travel for far distances in the water. So you want to kind of look at a small portion or stretch of water. But people have thought you can measure it from 5, 10, 20 kilometers away, and that is not really representative of the water quality in that particular area. However, in this study, they found that eDNA only travels about 1 kilometer downstream before it becomes too faint to detect. And this means that eDNA may be helpful in assessing and categorizing the biodiversity loss or gain in an area, and using this information may help to find more ways to protect our freshwater bodies.
Tidal Bore Rafting Resort is a company which takes passengers through the Shubenacadie River right here in Nova Scotia. Tidal bores are a strong tide that pushes up a river which empties into the ocean. The Bay of Fundy, which connects to the Shubi River, is known for the highest tides on Earth, which some people argue about, but since I live here, I've decided to state once and for all, we can say we're the highest tides on Earth.
No, I second that
opinion. It doesn't hurt anyone. We have the highest tides on Earth, which makes tidal bore rafting here a unique experience. Rafting guides in early June had a surprise when they came upon a stranded minke whale at low tide. The whale was in a mere 5 centimeters of water and was being pecked by crows. Dwight Barkhouse, the resort's rafting manager, said that they only had one group out at the time and reportedly missed the boar entirely because everyone was so concerned for the whale, as well as taking pictures. Barkhouse stayed with the whale as the other boats returned and documented the minke swimming towards the Bay of Fundy when the tide eventually came back in.
Oh, that's so good.
Minke whales are a whale that I'm somewhat familiar with. I've seen my fair share of them when boating with my grandparents growing up. I remember knowing them as like a very slick, like black, kind of smallish looking whale, but from doing some Googling, they actually have like a totally white underbelly that you can see when they're what's it called? When they jump. Breaching.
Yeah.
When they breach. But I've never actually witnessed it myself. They're the smallest of the greater whales. So greater whales kind of refers to all of your large whales, not your dolphins or your porpoises, you know, your humpbacks and your blue whales kind of thing. So they're not terribly large, but they're kind of this like slick, cute. I think they're kind of common around Newfoundland. I saw them somewhat frequently. But I'm glad to know that this minke got out safe. And yeah. I don't think they're a species of concern. I think they're actually doing quite well.
That's good. We love to see that here.
Yeah, it's good to see whales doing well.
Yeah.
Reading the story made me really want to go tidal bore rafting. I really want to go.
I think that would be fun.
We should go.
Sure. After we run our trip. Or do our triathlon, we'll...
No, that's next year. I want to go tidal bore rafting this year.
Okay.
You got $79 lying around?
Not me being unemployed.
That's fair.
All right. Well, thank you for that heartwarming story, Emily. I'm so happy to hear that minke whale is doing A-okay and is no longer being pecked by the most aggressive bird that I've ever met in my whole life.
Ooh, is this a story?
Nope. This is just my honest opinion.
I saw a girl get attacked by a crow once.
Yeah.
On campus.
Yep.
She had a muffin.
Yep. Oh yeah, they're vicious.
Bad idea. You can't leave the meal hall with a muffin.
Nope. I love those. I just want everybody to make sure that they're safe out there. And crows can be actually very vicious. You know, you're not supposed to wear sparkly jewelry. You can't wear anything like too bright and like reflective.
That's not going to stop me.
No. And you can't hold food. And it's only during like a certain period. And I think that's like when they have their young or when they're...
Probably this time of year.
Yeah. Now we're going to Africa. And I just wanted to tell this little quick story. And it was a really cool study that was done about elephants by Perdo et al. In 2024. And I'll mostly be talking about the news article that I read about this study. It was from CBC, but I thought it was so cool. In the study, they found that elephants might actually have names for each other. They found that there's particular vocalizations, and elephants can actually call on each other separately or as a whole group. And this has been seen in other, like a few other species, but it's very, very uncommon. I think they mentioned 4 other species, including humans.
Is it like with dogs, how like a dog recognizes its name?
It's not. The thing is, it's not a name that we give it.
Yeah. Like, do they give it to each other kind of thing?
Yeah, so they don't actually know. So it's
so cool.
Yeah, so it's a really new area. We all know that elephants are intelligent, like super, super intelligent animals. This study suggests that elephants can single an elephant out by using this specific vocalization. They used AI to analyze the audio recordings they found, and they also played the audio recordings for a group of 17 elephants. They found when the call was meant for them, the elephant responded more and made more noise and was like more excited. But this was compared to when an audio that was played wasn't directly made for them. There's something in this vocalization where they understand that message is for them. This is a novel area of study, and further insight into vocalizations of elephants is key for conservation efforts, as they described in this article. Maybe using them to ward off elephants from areas that might cause them danger or anything like that. So to get a group of elephants to move away, because all the infrastructure we have now for elephants, they're just too smart and they just go right past it and they could end up getting seriously injured. As well, they're unsure of actually which part of the vocalization contains the so-called name, or in fact how they actually receive their name. It's currently being hypothesized that they received these names from their mothers, but this is obviously like a huge speculation and would need to be further researched, and I think that is going to be really difficult to prove.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think they mentioned
you'd need a really long-term like audio study. That's so cool.
Yeah, I think they mentioned the only other, because it's not like dogs where we call on them and they kind of know. It's like,
yeah, because they have like a reward association kind of thing going on.
It's like dolphins communicating with each other or parrots who communicate with each other. But these, like, they can specific, like, they have a specific call for specific individuals and a difference, but like varying on any population and any individual. And I think that's really interesting. Yeah.
That's incredible. And I wonder too if that's even something that would occur in all different elephant groups, if just some would do that, or super cool.
I think this study was kind of like used like over 100 elephant vocalizations.
So it was more than just one like troop.
Yeah, so this was just played for 17 elephants, and I think this study was done in like a national reserve or something like that. So yeah, I think it was pretty interesting, and I just, like, I couldn't not include that study.
Oh yeah, of course not.
All right, on to everybody's favorite segment. Trivia!
Clara, what are baby echidnas called?
I hope I have some options, because I didn't even know what they were.
Did you know what they were after I, like, described what they were?
No, I still can't picture them.
Look up an echidna.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wait. No, it's... Oh, here.
I was talking about echinoderms.
Yes! That's when I got so confused, because I was like, they both have, like, very similar letters in them.
Yeah, like, no duh, they found a starfish in the shark's...
Yes, that's what?
Far less interesting.
But you said like 50 pounds or something. I was like, that's a huge starfish.
50 centimeters.
Oh, 50 centimeters? That's a huge starfish.
Not even. Okay. Clara, what are baby echidnas called? A. A hoglet. B. A puggle. C. An eckling. Or D. A prickling.
They're all so cute. I'm going to go with C.
An eagling?
Yeah.
No, it's B, a puggle.
That was my next guess. I thought, aren't like baby hedgehogs called that or something?
Baby hedgehogs are called hoglets, which I added in there to trick you.
Didn't work. But that is so freaking cute. I wish they could be named everything that was there, because that's adorable.
I've heard that, I was looking it up, and it seems like, not that I think this is a very concrete scientific terminology, but I also saw that baby, what are they called, platypuses are also called puggles, so they share a baby name.
So cute, the puggles. Okay, Emily, this should be an easy one. What percentage of our water is fresh water? 8%, 2.5%, 5%, or 3%?
I think it's 3%.
And I think you're right.
This one felt wrong to me.
But
is it like that one is like why they called the right whale? Have we ever figured?
Hey, I read that somewhere.
You read this somewhere too, but you.
I did. It feels wrong though. Can you guess, without any multiple choice, what the minke whale's biggest predator is?
Other than humans?
Other than humans.
Tiger shark.
No. What's our big predator here, do you think?
Black bear.
An orca whale!
Oh, that was my third death. You know, I was just trying to be humorous. The black bears do be out there swimming, though. I don't know.
I don't think they could get a whale.
I also don't know if they're really out there swimming. Not in the Bay of Fundy.
Not in the Bay of Fundy.
When were European red fox introduced to Australia? 1893, 1870, 1900, or 1910?
1890? Was that an option?
93? No. 90 wasn't an option, but 93 was.
Oh, 93 then.
That's incorrect. It's 1870. So they were introduced for hunting purposes by European settlers initially, but obviously now they cause a huge problem for the native species in that environment. Sad. Get rid of the European red fox in Australia.
A couple nice coats. Sorry, there's probably a lot of fox lovers out there.
Yeah.
It is widely thought that the Ceratopsis' frills are used for defense. What else do scientists think that they were used for? Thermoregulation, mate attraction, scent marking, or navigating dense vegetation?
Ooh, there's some good ones in there. Mating.
Gosh. Thermoregulation.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. I know nothing about dinosaurs.
Yeah, I used to play on my dad's computer when I went to, like, his work. I used to play, like, these old computer games that were, like, you're an archaeologist, like, digging up dinosaur bones. But I never actually, like, knew anything about them.
Yeah.
I don't know much about dinosaurs.
You ever see those videos of those kids who are, like, absolutely crazy at naming all the dinosaurs?
And they're so cool.
I know. I wish I could be them. Okay. My last question. What animal predates the adult Iberian lynx? Wolves, feral dogs, foxes, and nothing. It's an apex predator.
Maybe feral dogs?
Incorrect. They're actually an apex predator. But this was kind of a tricky trick question. So they are an apex predator in their environment, but something that's particularly interesting is that their young can be killed by any of those three predators, which were the wolves, the feral dogs, and the foxes. Mm. And of course, we know that the main predator in this instance would actually be the human, but I didn't include that because I wanted to focus on things that weren't humans, and we've already talked about that a little bit, so yeah. Well, that's it. If you guys get a chance, follow us on Instagram. We're going to be posting some pretty cool pictures of these amazing organisms. And I'm sure Emily has some really cool bones that she's going to put on there.
I've got bones.
Oh, yeah. For sure. I'm excited to see them. And our Instagram is Write Up Your Algae Podcast.
Hell yeah.
Or if you have any issues with our episode today, or any issues with us in general, or just...
If you have any personal issues with me or Clara, feel free to email us at rubypodcast@outlook.com. That's RUYA podcast@outlook.com.
And also, you can just send us a quick email to say that you also like us, but, you know, if that's not the case and you think we should stop, I mean...
And we lost our 5 stars on Spotify, so if you want to go and give us a 5-star review on any of the platforms that you use to listen to our lovely show.
Where's our greatest listeners?
Oh, shout out to Council Bluffs in Iowa?
Yeah.
Yeah, seems like you guys really like the CRISPR episode. Love you guys, I guess.
Tell us why.
Yeah, tell us why we have more listeners than to any of our other episodes combined to just the CRISPR episode from Council Bluffs, Idaho? No, it's Iowa.
Yeah, and like, was it a school project?
Yeah.
Like, question mark?
And you can someone make you? Thank you for listening.
And we hope this episode was right up your algae.